thank you for downloading Business Matters, on air 5 days a week at 9 a.m. Singapore time and 8 p.m. New York time. If you're hungry for more, download our new weekly show, The Food Chain, a programme about the economics, science and culture behind what we eat and drink. Search online for The Food Chain podcast.
It's 1 o'clock GMT. Hello, I'm Roger Hearing, and this is Business Matters on the BBC World Service. We're connecting the time zones. Today we're live in Hong Kong and San Francisco. Coming up on the programme, closed ports along the US West Coast as talks break down between longshoremen and the port owners. An economic crisis looms as Asian imports sit in the docks.
I think a group of third graders could probably reach an agreement sooner on this kind of an issue. And we've been telling the companies, this is not a big problem. Let's work it out. Let's solve it. And let's move on and help people get their containers, because it's just not fair to hold them captive out on those ships.
Also today, the huge trade in high-quality second-hand clothes in Uganda and Facebook immortality, a way to hand over your page to those who live on after you. That's Business Matters here on the BBC after the latest BBC News.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. European leaders say they may impose more sanctions on Russia if it fails to observe a new ceasefire deal in eastern Ukraine. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel said the European Union was already drawing up further sanctions. She was speaking after briefing EU leaders on the agreement she and the French president brokered between the leaders of Russia and Ukraine. Damien Grammaticus reports from Brussels.
In the past 2 days, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel has barely slept. She'd brokered the ceasefire and peace plan in Minsk, then flown straight to the European summit in Brussels to brief the 27 other European leaders. The deal brought, in her words, just a glimmer of hope, no more, no less, that the conflict in Ukraine could be halted. But as she left the summit, she also had a warning for Russia's president and the separatists he has supported and armed. EU leaders, she said, had asked for new sanctions to be prepared in case the ceasefire does not hold.
At the same summit in Brussels, Chancellor Merkel and the Greek Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, spoke positively about the prospects for resolving disagreements over Greece's demands for debt relief. Mrs. Merkel said her government was prepared to compromise, while Mr. Tsipras said he was confident that a mutually acceptable solution could be found. The Turkish President, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has criticised President Obama for not speaking out about the killings of three young Muslims in North Carolina. Earlier, the father of one of the three people shot dead in the Chapel Hill district told mourners at their funeral that the killings were a hate crime. From Washington, Naomi Grimley reports.
Police estimated that over 5,000 people were in attendance at the funerals of the three Muslims who were shot dead in Chapel Hill on Tuesday. Investigations are still ongoing as to whether the gunman was acting out of religious hatred. The White House originally said it would await the results of the police inquiries before commenting. But now Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has intervened, arguing senior figures in the Obama administration should have been more outspoken after the shootings. "If you stay silent when faced with an incident like this," he said, "the world will stay silent towards you."
There's been chaos in the South African parliament as President Jacob Zuma attempted to deliver his annual State of the Nation address. The Speaker of Parliament summoned police to expel members of the opposition Economic Freedom Fighters Party, led by Julius Malema. The party had repeatedly interrupted proceedings, demanding that President Zuma repay public money spent upgrading his private residence. Mr. Malema said his party wouldn't be silenced.
"We are going to continue holding this executive accountable. We are going to be part of this parliament. We are not going anywhere. We'll continue to raise our issues without fear or favour."
World news from the BBC. A female suicide bomber has blown herself up in a busy market in the town of Biu in northeastern Nigeria, killing at least 6 people. Local vigilantes seized 2 other suspected bombers, both teenage girls, after the explosives strapped around their bodies failed to detonate. Police and government officials from Kosovo, Serbia, Hungary, Austria and Germany have been holding talks to find ways to stem a growing exodus of migrants from Kosovo into the European Union. Political pressure is growing in Germany and Austria to fast-track deportations of Kosovars. Nick Thorpe reports.
Until a few days ago, this 175-kilometre stretch of European Union border was wide open and tens of thousands of migrants crossed it. 18,000 have been caught in Hungary so far this year alone. Now police reinforcements have arrived and new refugee centres have opened. Hungary is a member of the Schengen group of countries within the EU, which have no internal border controls. Now Hungarian police prevent Kosovars from boarding trains for Austria and Germany, and police checks on vehicles heading west have been stepped up.
An Argentine oil company says it will withdraw from an area of the Peruvian Amazon rainforest where it's been prospecting for gas deposits. The company, Plus Petrol, was asked to leave by the Peruvian government after the death of a demonstrator in Junin province during violent protests against the company. Research by Austrian scientists is suggesting something that dog lovers have long suspected, that man's best friend can tell the difference between our happy and angry faces. The scientists showed dogs images on a screen of happy or angry faces. Half the dogs got a treat for pressing their noses against the angry faces, and the other half were rewarded for touching the happy ones. Later, the dogs were shown pictures of happy or angry faces they hadn't seen before and were still able to tell the difference. BBC News.
Hello and welcome to Business Matters. I'm Roger Hearing. Coming up on today's programme, lots of ships, lots of containers, but no goods being unloaded on America's West Coast. A labour dispute has stopped imports from Asia worth billions of dollars. Also, the best clothes in Uganda, not new, but second-hand and going fast, apparently. And memories are made of this, a way to hand your Facebook page on after you die.
You do get people who remain widows and widowers for the rest of their lives. And for them, that might be a constant source of solace, something they can go back to, in the same way that we always used to go back to printed photographs, for example.
And joining me throughout the programme are my two guests on opposite sides of the Pacific, Lily Kuo of Quartz magazine, who's joining us from Hong Kong, and Alison van Diggelen, host of the radio programme Fresh Dialogues, who's joining us from San Francisco. But let's start in and around San Francisco and the rest of California, and indeed the rest of the US West Coast, where the ports are at a standstill. Billions of dollars of imports are sitting at the docks, containers of car parts, medical equipment, furniture, many other items brought from Asia are going nowhere. And US exports aren't moving either. It's all down to a labour dispute that's pitted the International Longshore and Warehouse Union against the port owners, the Pacific Maritime Association. Now, it's hugely costly and very damaging to the Californian and indeed the wider US economy. So what exactly is the dispute about? Well, I've been speaking to union spokesman Craig Merrilies.
Here's the interesting thing. Usually people think, well, it must be about money. And of course, money's always the bottom line, especially for the bean counters. But that's not the case here. The money is good. Workers make a good salary in U.S. dollars. They're paid $26 to $41 an hour and receive good health and insurance benefits. So that's not the issue. They haven't hung up over pay in decades. The issue here has to do with how to resolve conflicts that arise on the job when the contract is in effect. And we use a system of what we call arbitrators or judges or referees to make these decisions and keep things moving along. Now, the current system allows these folks to serve for life. The union members would like that system to be altered and see if we couldn't have people serve for a shorter period of time and then come up for renewal regularly and allow both parties to concur. If they don't, they can find someone they agree on. But if you can believe it, that is what we're quarreling about and what the companies have shut down the ports over.
Well, Craig, let me clarify that. So what it means, I mean, for example, it's if there's a dispute over whose job it is to empty one particular ship, is that what it's about?
Well, let's say a dispute arises over a safety issue because the docks are dangerous and there's a lot of concern about whether or not the safety rules are being followed. If you thought there was a problem, you might say, look, this isn't safe. And the company boss says, look, it's safe. I'm telling you it's safe. You do it or you're going to be fired. And the worker says, well, let's take this to the arbitrator. Let's have them decide and they'll make the decision. So you call up the arbitrator and the arbitrator makes a decision and you have to live with it. And that's the way it works. The current system allows that person to be appointed for life. And there have been some concerns that have arisen with these lifetime appointments in some cases. So workers would like to see that term limited for an amount of time, and they can continue to serve if both sides agree, but that's what we're talking about. And over all this, the employers have closed the ports and caused billions of dollars in damage and causing all sorts of business owners, especially small business, to be without their containers.
That, it does seem extraordinary, but I suppose you could turn it back on you guys and say, well, over what seems like a pretty small issue, you guys aren't budging, and that's why you're really damaging the economy in this way.
Well, look, it takes both sides to reach an agreement and make a compromise, but I don't think anybody would disagree that there isn't an easy way to resolve a conflict like this, unless you're just opposed and stubborn and can't make a compromise. We've been trying to sit down with the companies for almost a week, and they haven't come to the negotiating table. So finally, they're back today. We're hopeful that a compromise will be reached on this. You know, I think a group of third graders could probably reach an agreement sooner on this kind of an issue. And we've been telling the companies, this is not a big problem. Let's work it out. Let's solve it. Let's resolve it. And let's move on and help people get their containers, because it's just not fair to hold them captive out on those ships.
Craig Merrilee. So what do the port bosses say? Well, my colleague Samira Hussain spoke to John Slangerup of Long Beach Port.
The root of the issues are about this dramatically changing marketplace we find ourselves in. And the workers are naturally very concerned about where they fit into the future. Ports are getting more automated. Their jobs, they fear, will be phased out over time or reduced. And reality is that if we can continue to grow, job growth will continue even though we get more and more efficient at it. So most of those issues have been addressed, to my knowledge, and I think the labor leadership understands that automation and technology is here to stay. Big ships are here to stay, and they must adapt, and they recognize that.
What are the long-term effects of this? Are you worried that your ports will lose business as a result?
The Southern California port complex in San Pedro Bay is the most direct and the most efficient and fastest route from Asia to the interior of the United States. Things like this slowdown directly affect our customers, ultimately, who are the shippers who bring the containers through. So we need to fix this. We can fix this. Labor will be resolved shortly. I don't know how many days, but it's not weeks or months. And in my view, once that's done, we'll get back on track very quickly.
You've been in this job for about a year. Tough time to be taking on the role of CEO.
Well, you know, it's not been as difficult as it's been challenging. I like a challenge, and we have so many exciting things going on that this is just an anomaly. I mean, we have opportunities to dramatically improve the way we do the business. I come out of a logistics background, and our system needs some improvement. And with those improvements, we will become even more competitive and a great force to be reckoned with.
John Slangerup. But what about the economic effect of this dispute? Jock O'Connell is an international trade advisor at Beacon Economics.
The fact that the Western ports have been suffering from severe congestion problems for the better part of the last 12 months means that if there is a shutdown of the ports by the terminal operators, that the effect will be less abrupt than if the ports have been behaving normally. So still, though, there will be a significant impact on certainly retail, and as well as manufacturing. A lot of companies that manufacture goods in the United States rely upon imported goods coming in from the Far East that transit West Coast ports. So there'll be an effect there. Most of the effect, though, will be local, affecting regional truck drivers and people who work in the logistics sector who are charged with processing the goods that are imported through the West Coast ports. About 70% of the goods coming in through the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, the nation's largest maritime terminal, are actually destined for locations outside of Southern California. So there's a great deal of effort involved in moving those goods elsewhere throughout North America.
I've heard estimates of as many as a couple of billion dollars a day as the cost of this. Do you think that's realistic?
Well, calculating the actual impact of something like this is rather a fool's errand. The number $2 billion, $2.5 billion are really just big round numbers that are surrogates for an honest statement of it will have a significant impact.
And as it continues, presumably the impact will build greater. I mean, just the sheer amount of time that these ports are closed down for.
That's true. The economic impact is to a large extent a function of the duration. The previous time that the ports were closed was in 2002, and that lockout or strike lasted for 10 days and resulted in the president invoking federal legislation that sent the workers back to work. That's what we probably could expect under worst-case scenarios with what's going on right now.
Which suggests it's got the nature of a national emergency about it.
That's what the president would have to declare as in order to invoke the provisions of the Taft-Hartley Act, which was designed to deal with situations of this sort. Yes, he would have to call it a national emergency. Whether it is a true economic emergency is another question. The economic impact of $2 billion a day must be reckoned against the backdrop of the fact that the U.S. is a $17 trillion a year economy.
Jock O'Connell there of Beacon Economics. Now, in Uganda, second-hand clothes are often of better quality, coming from Europe, Japan and the U.S., and cheaper than new clothes. The trade in the capital, Kampala, is so big, it's the hub for used clothes from right across East Africa. And it's given rise to a new kind of buyer, personal shoppers. As part of our Richer World series, Catherine Byarahanga went to a second-hand clothes market to find out more.
It's just after dawn and the clothes section of Owino Market is in full swing. There are dozens of sellers perched up on concrete slabs calling out for customers, and there are plenty of them. There are clothes strewn everywhere, some are even hanging up on wires by the roof. And if you haven't had your breakfast, there are even guys selling samosas and donuts. Today we're following Grace Asimwe. She supplies clothes to some of the most fashionable and richest ladies in Kampala, and this is where she does her shopping. Well, Grace, tell me what you're doing now.
We are picking clothes. As you can see, we are all ugly muffins.
You're out of breath. You have to be quick.
Yeah, be very fast so that you can pick out the nice ones. As you can see, I have a competitor.
Yeah.
So when he's going, No.
Grace, we're spending our time now.
Nyamba, what's your name?
Jen.
And where do you sell your clothes?
Who, I? Mm. I sell them from here. I can sell them to Grace.
She picks?
Yes.
Then she can sell it to me. Or if not me, then there are other people who do the same job as I do. So then she sells them to them.
So how does it feel? You're standing next to somebody who will end up selling you the clothes that you could have found yourself.
It's okay for her to sell to me because, I mean, she's also earning a living, yeah, from it.
And how much would she charge you? So let's say that you have this top, which is, you know, a nice chiffon blouse. How much will you buy it and how much will Jane sell it to you for?
If the belt owner sells it to her, say, for example, like 7,000, she'll sell it to me at 10,000.
I really like some of the clothes on offer. They're really nice blouses with nice materials, bright colours, something I could wear to go out or for work. You could say it's just like buying vintage clothing in London. After a 20-minute drive from Owino Market, we get to Grace's small shop. She sorts through the clothes she bought, stuffed in a black backpack.
I'm so happy, because there are times when you go and you do not find anything. And at least today I got several tops. And some dresses. I got a very nice red dress, and it's a Calvin Klein.
Calvin Klein?
Yes. Yeah, so it's this red one is the best buy of the day.
How much did you buy the Calvin Klein dress for, and how much will you sell it for as well?
Today, this one, I bought it at 50,000, so I might sell it at 70 or 80,000, depending on how we bargain with the customer.
So 50,000, that's about $20, and you make a $5 profit off of it.
Yes.
Grace didn't notice that some of the clothes were either torn or stained back at the market. She will take them to a tailor or wash them herself. Nothing will go to waste if she can help it. For now, she packs up her bag again with items for one of her best customers.
Oh, hi, Hatima Nalugwa Sekaya is a news anchor with NTV, a local channel. She meets Grace in the office car park.
I just hope it fits.
And today you have mix.
I love green. She really brings the products closer. It helps me manage my time. It helps me, you know. She does a good job. You can go downtown and fail to get what you want, but she takes the time to find the product you really like. And just like you've seen, everything she has brought, I really liked.
Most people give away clothes to help the poor. In Uganda, they're offering thousands of people like Grace the opportunity to make a living and help support their families.
I need like 3 black skirts. Will I be putting on 1 black skirt for everything?
So it fades out, eh?
So do you have 1 week?
One week?
Yes.
I'm going to do my best. How I do my stuff. I'll call you I get this.
Catherine Biarahanga there with the clothes shoppers of Kampala. Let's take a little break and bring ourselves right up to date with the news with Marion Marshall.
European leaders say more sanctions could be imposed on Russia if it fails to keep to a deal to end the fighting in eastern Ukraine. The German and Greek leaders have expressed optimism about the chances of resolving the standoff over Greece's international bailout. Turkey's president has criticised Barack Obama for staying silent about the killings of 3 young Muslims in North Carolina. And there's been chaos in the South African parliament, where police were called in to expel MPs who tried to disrupt a key speech by President Zuma.
Marion, thanks. Now let's bring in my guest in a slightly more formal way. Lily Kuo of Quartz is in Hong Kong with us. Lily, I'll say good morning to you.
How's it going?
Well, thank you, and good to have you back on the programme once again. And also, welcome return for Alison van Diggelen. And Alison, I'll say good evening to you because you're in San Francisco.
Good evening, Roger. Good to join you.
Good to have you back, and welcome to both of you. Now, I'm going to ask you both, Lily, do you have a Facebook page?
I do.
And Alison, I bet you do too.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can't live in Silicon Valley without one.
It's kind of like that. But it's rather interesting. I mean, if you, and perish the thought that you should, were to think that you might be about to live, to breathe your last, would you want to hand on your Facebook page to someone else, or would you want to destroy it? Lily, what would you want to do?
I think I would probably want to destroy it. I've seen a few Facebook pages of people that have passed, and I don't know. I guess there's something about it that I know it can be used as a memorial, and people like it, and they take some comfort in posting messages and posting them as if they're communicating with the person, like saying, you know, miss you, thinking about you. But for some reason, I don't really like that happening on Facebook.
No, it does seem a bit weird. Alison, what do you think? Would you want to hand yours on to somebody?
I think it's a very good idea, and I think I'm going to put it on my to-do list because I think it would be wonderfully cathartic for the people I leave behind just to, you know, have a place to write and share. Gillian Tett of the FT wrote a fantastic piece a few months ago about this happening to a friend of hers, son dying, and they had the Facebook page, and that became the place for everyone around the world to comment. And it was really touching for the mum, who was bereft, to see how much her son had impacted people's lives all over the world. Mm-hmm. So I like the idea from that point of view.
It is interesting, because, I mean, social media obviously are changing all the time and challenging the ways that we've become used to dealing with key moments of life like birth, childhood, love, partnerships, and inevitably death. Some people do find it a bit unnerving, as we said there, that their Facebook page with messages and pictures might live on after them. But Facebook have taken this all on board. In the past, you could memorialise a page in the way you were talking about there, Alison, but now they're offering something a bit different, so you can actually give it to someone to be inherited, if you like, and even added to afterwards. Vanessa Callison-Birch from Facebook told me how it works.
We have offered the ability to memorialize an account for a number of years. And throughout that process, we heard from people that there's even more that we could do to give people a choice in what happens to the future of their account and to better support family and friends who are grieving someone they've lost.
So what actually happens? Is there a particular button that you push or whatever on the site? Is that the way it works?
So we've introduced a new feature. You'll find it under your account settings in the security section. Down at the bottom, it's called Legacy Contact. And that's where you have the opportunity to do one of two things. You can let Facebook know that you'd like your account deleted in the future after you pass away, or you can choose a close family member or a friend who will care for your account in very specific ways after you pass away.
And have people actually asked for this? Have they spoken to Facebook and said, look, we want this kind of service?
Yes. This is based on the input that we've gotten from people who've experienced loss on Facebook and communicated to us the needs that they had. So, for example, the legacy contact is able to pin a post at the top of the timeline of the person who passed away. That's to share memorial service information or another special message.
And that was Vanessa Callison-Birch from Facebook on the old technology of phones. Not a very good line, as you could hear there. Stuart Mackay is someone who would have liked to have had this option. His wife, Vicky, died in 2011, aged only 35. He told me what happened to her Facebook page.
Initially, I left it as it was for about 2 or 3 weeks. And then I contacted Facebook and asked them to memorialise it, which basically meant it was frozen as it was at the time. Having read the article on the BBC news pages on the internet this evening, the changes they're looking at making would be helpful if they were retrospective because, for example, Vicky, my wife's, her brother managed to delete his Facebook account and create a new one. But because there's not the option to add new friends, he no longer has access to anything that was on her page.
So it was you could do something with it, but it just didn't. It didn't have the kind of effect that she probably would have wanted. Actually,
no. It was completely frozen in time. I mean, you can, if you're an existing friend of her at the time that it was memorialised, you can add comments to her pages, but beyond that, there's nothing to do.
If you had been able to use this system with Vicky's page, just tell me what kind of things you would have been trying to do.
As much as anything, you can keep it more alive because, I mean, the fact that you can respond to new friend requests means that you can add the people that count. The account is memorialised still, but it means that you can update the pictures on it, which you couldn't do. You can't tag someone who's deceased. So, if, for example, an old friend says, look, I found this photo of such and such, you can't then add that into their page because it's frozen.
And how long would you imagine that this page would then continue? I mean, would it just be something that throughout the rest of your life you keep having there, or would there be a time period, do you think, at which point you think, well, that's it, and kind of you put it away?
Again, it's a personal thing. I mean, you do get people who are widowed for whatever reason who remain widows and widowers for the rest of their lives without finding another partner. And for them, that might be a constant source of solace, something they can go back to, in the same way that we always used to go back to printed photographs, for example. Alternatively, the option is still there to delete the page with Facebook, should you desire to do so.
Stuart Mackay there, talking about the page belonging to his wife Vicky and what's happened to that. Lily, you can understand how it can be a great comfort having this sort of way of still being able to keep the page active.
Definitely, and it wasn't really until recently that I kind of learned how funerals actually serve that sort of cathartic experience. And there's something about mourning in with a group of people and in public too, and sort of sharing that, maybe not in public, but with a group of people. And so I guess I can see how Facebook would also, you know, do that too, and you can read other people's messages. And
yeah, because I mean, Alison, Facebook has become almost like a, you know, a photo album of the past, isn't it? Really, it fulfills that function that a photo album would have had before.
Yes, I think so. And it also gives people a chance to really reflect on what they want to say to the grieving family, because I think, I mean, everyone knows about, you know, the horrendous comments that some people say well-meaning. And I think when you have time to think about it and compose something and write something, it might actually result in more meaningful words of sympathy.
Alison, thanks. And we're back in a moment. Welcome back to Business Matters with me, Roger Hearing, and my guest today, Alison van Diegelen and Lily Kuo. Now, I'm guessing that probably neither of you have heard of Charles and David Koch. Maybe you have. They are, in fact, big players in American politics. They aren't politicians. They're financiers and businessmen. What they do have is a lot of money and the willingness to support candidates for election who share their libertarian political views. They have so much money to play with, they aim, in fact, to raise more than $800 million before 2016, that the brothers are serious players in US elections. Andy Kroll of Mother Jones magazine has been writing about them.
Yeah, they are this dynastic pair of brothers who identify and espouse beliefs that are in line with, you know, libertarian beliefs, which means that they are very against regulation and, frankly, government in any sort of significant way. But they are also pro same-sex marriage, and they're anti-war. And so they're these very ideological brothers who, over the last 30 to 40 years, have invested hundreds of millions of dollars into pushing the country in a direction that suits, you know, their views and that better matches their views. And they do it through influencing politics and campaigns. They do it through influencing universities and higher education. They do it through organizing on the ground in states around this country.
Where does their money come from?
They are the heirs to a petrochemical company that was started by, you know, their father. And the company is called Koch Industries today, and it's the second largest private corporation in America. And it has interests in a number of industries, not only energy, but also in textiles and in agriculture. They are behind some of the very well-known brands here in the United States, like Brawny Paper Towel and the Lycra sort of stretch fabric. So their presence is everywhere, though they are not that well known as a company to the average person, or at least they weren't until about 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, because it's become quite clear that they are a major input into American politics, because it's not just their money. I mean, they're good at raising money as well, aren't they?
That's absolutely right. They have, over the past decade, 10, 12 years, grown a network of wealthy business owners, CEOs, entrepreneurs, Horatio Alger types, to sort of join their cause. And the way that that network works today is that the Kochs convene these donor retreats, if you will, twice a year, typically, once in the winter, once in the summer, at very luxurious resorts around the country in California or in the mountains in Colorado. And these retreats serve as a showcase for organizations that are promoting the, you know, Koch agenda, trying to influence elections to elect Koch-affiliated or Koch-aligned candidates. And it's also a fundraising event as well. Near the end of these biannual summits, there's a luncheon, and these donors who have been brought together by the Kochs, you know, stand up and they pledge $500,000, $1 million, $5 million toward the cause, toward efforts to push the country in this pro-business, free market direction.
And in America, there's no limit to the amount of money you can put in that direction if it goes through a political committee. Is that right?
Well, there's no effective limit right now. I mean, there are still some restrictions on money given to political candidates, on money given to political action committees, which aren't affiliated with a candidate, but maybe are affiliated with a company or are affiliated with a political party, Democratic Party, the Republican Party. But since the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United in 2010, the law and subsequent decisions in the courts and in Washington, there really aren't limits if you want to influence elections. There are ways to give unlimited sums of money to influence both politics and to shape the debate around issues on taxes, on the environment, on government regulation. And the thing that makes the Kochs so unique is that they and their acolytes put their money into all these different venues, you know, politics and beyond.
And what they do is they will find a candidate who is a support some of what they say, particular issues, and then they pump money into their campaign. I mean, is it just beyond Capitol Hill? I mean, does it go to the presidency? Would they support Republican candidates for the presidency?
Yeah, they have supported Republican candidates for the presidency. You know, in 2012, they did not get involved in a particularly significant way during the primary season when the Republican candidates were still fighting it out for the party's nomination. But once the nominee was Mitt Romney in the spring and summer of 2012, they did become very involved. And when I say they, I mean both members of the Koch family, but also the donors that are part of their network or that are in their club. So they do get behind it. Now, what we're watching and what's going to be very intriguing heading into, I guess, a year from now, the 2016 Republican primary season, is whether the Kochs and their donor friends rally behind one candidate and try to push that candidate to the forefront, or whether they sort of step back and say, we'll let this take its natural course, and then once there is a nominee, we'll get involved. And a lot of us are really watching for that.
Andy Kroll there of Mother Jones. And, of course, there are people funding many other candidates on all sides. Alison, what do you think is the effect of money on this scale? We're talking a pretty massive scale on US politics.
It is massive, and it seems to be growing. It's a little bit scary. I mean, I think you assumed that I hadn't heard of the Koch brothers, but I can assure you, because I cover climate change in particular, I'm very aware of the Koch brothers, because they're secretly funding climate denial, basically a climate denial machine.
In what way? Can you explain that? They're secretly funding it?
Well, they have been funding various foundations with wonderful names that you would think you could get behind, like the Heritage Foundation. But what the Heritage Foundation spends most of its time doing is pulling apart real climate scientists' studies and reports and trying to undermine them. And so that's what they're doing, just scientist by scientist, report by report, undermining the credibility of the scientists.
Well, I guess they'd say that they're putting their money behind different views, you know, airing views that perhaps are not mainstream.
Well, that's the interesting thing. There's a huge difference between what people think about climate change in America versus in Europe and the rest of the world. I think for the rest of the world, it's a done deal. It's an accepted truth. But here in America, and I think a lot of people would agree with me on this, the Koch brothers, their machine of climate denial has actually helped muddy the water so that a lot of people aren't quite sure. And especially if you look at Republican candidates, a lot of them are, you know, they talk about, well, the science isn't a hard fact. And they're wary of actually admitting that there is such a thing as global warming going on. So I think they are having an effect.
Okay, well, but staying with the area of political funding, now I'm interested, Lily, where you are, Hong Kong. I mean, obviously it's part of China, but it has its own kind of political system. Does big money there play a big part in the elections that do happen?
I think a lot of critics of the system would say that there aren't really elections in Hong Kong, and that's part of what all the protests were about just late last year. So, but there is definitely one of the big complaints from critics on Hong Kong's political system is the influence of money, aside from the elections. I think that right now there is talk about establishing some sort of a political donation law, because right now lawmakers are supposed to declare a certain amount. I think it's if it's over 10,000 Hong Kong dollars, they have to declare, and they're supposed to declare it within, you know, 2 weeks. And recently there have been some, what people say are scandals with, you know, the head of a media company that's pretty pro-democratic reforms and critical of China, donating a lot of money to political parties that are also kind of a little bit anti-China. So that's, you know, that's kind of a...
Because there is a lot of money, obviously, in Hong Kong, a lot of very rich people who could, I suppose, deploy that money.
Yeah, the idea is that Hong Kong politics and the reason why the elections... Some people say the reason why elections aren't genuinely... there aren't genuine democratic elections is because these interests, these people, these, you know, Hong Kong tycoons, property tycoons, and so on, they want to keep the system as is. And in that system, the head of Hong Kong, the chief executive, is picked by a committee. Supposedly, it's supposed to be broadly representative, but it mostly represents business interests.
And coming back to you, Alison, is there any moves to try and... I mean, we heard that there was a case some time back going to the Supreme Court where there was an attempt to try and clear, I suppose, the position as far as money and politics is concerned. But is there any renewed attempt ahead of the 2016 election to try to restrict in any way how much money can be put into campaigns?
Not that I'm aware of. I think there seems to be the dominance of the 1% here in the U.S. I mean, they're influencing what is happening in the U.S. in four ways: through policy, through courtroom decisions, through TV ads, and through the education system. They seem to be unfettered in their ability. And perhaps the court case you were referring to is Citizens United, but that actually effectively gave more power to these political action committees and allowed them to do to create what they call dark money groups, these groups where they're not actually declaring where the money is coming from that they're using. So it's all rather doom and gloom, to be honest.
But we talked there about the Koch brothers, and they tend to be backing Republicans. They are, in fact, in favour, I think, of gay marriage and things. So it's a fairly different line, perhaps, to some you'd find the Republicans. But also where you are, around Silicon Valley, there are a large number of very wealthy individuals who have quite a liberal outlook and one could deploy their money there. Similarly, people, I guess, from Hollywood. Does that happen too?
It is happening. I mean, the person of note is Tom Steyer, and he's a San Francisco former money man who's now really putting a lot of his millions into an organization called the Next Gen Climate. And they're basically, they are getting involved in politics. They're targeting mostly Republican candidates, those that are rejecting climate science. So I'm all in favor of that, to expose these people with their crazy science ideas.
But that's big money too, isn't it? That's big money too.
That is big money. I agree, that is big money. But I think it's a drop in the bucket compared to what the Koch brothers is able to leverage from the other side. And I think the other thing with Tom Steyer is he has the science behind him.
Well, yeah, yes, but I suppose...
But I think, to be honest, it's shameful that this big money from the Koch brothers is being used to fund this anti-science and impacting not just America, but the rest of the planet.
Although the people you're talking about are trying to put big money on the other side as well. So,
yeah, but I think they're just trying to make things clear. You know, it's science is science, right? They're trying to expose the truth of the science and the lies of the anti-science.
Okay. So. Well, we'll leave the argument there. It's an interesting one, certainly. Marion, can you bring us up to date with the news?
European leaders say more sanctions could be imposed on Russia if it fails to keep to a deal to end the fighting in eastern Ukraine. The German and Greek leaders have expressed optimism about the chances of resolving the standoff over Greece's international bailout. Turkey's president has criticised Barack Obama for staying silent about the killings of three young Muslims in North Carolina. There's been chaos in the South African parliament, where police were called in to expel MPs who tried to disrupt a key speech by President Zuma. On the markets, the Nikkei is currently trading at 17,931, and a dollar is worth 119 yen.
Marion, thanks. Now it's the moment where we tend to link up with one of our reporters. Today it's Cindy Su joining us live from Taipei in Taiwan. Now, Cindy, it does almost seem that any time we talk to someone where you are, in Malaysia or many parts of that part of the world, we talk about air crashes. It seems extraordinary. And I gather the latest thing, the Transasia airline, of course we know about the accident, and they're offering the bereaved families money, but the bereaved families don't want it. What's going on?
Right. And I should first address what you just brought up, which is it seems like that, doesn't it, that, you know, there are a lot of plane crashes in Asia recently. And I think some of the experts have been saying that the reason for that is because of the increased ability for Asians to travel. And there are a lot of budget airlines that make it possible for them to afford the airfare. So Asians in this part of the world are getting richer, and they are able to travel more now. And the airlines are trying to seize this opportunity to make more money. And many of them have been booming. In Taiwan, for instance, has seen its number of flights flown by its airlines rise rapidly, and including Transasia's. And, you know, many of the pilots, they do have to undergo sufficient training before they can fly the airplanes. But, you know, there are a lot of questions raised since this air crash about whether the pilots are being overworked or whether they had enough training and whether they were tested often enough. And in fact, recently there was a test of the Transasia pilots who fly the ATR type of airplane, which was involved in the crash. And 10 of them failed the test. It was a verbal oral test on how to handle emergency procedures, including like engine failure.
That's pretty worrying, isn't it? If that's failing the test.
And, Yeah, they have about 49 pilots who fly these airplanes, and 10 of them fail. But there's another 19 who haven't taken the test yet because they were off or they were sick or something. So the failure rate could be higher than that. Actually, it could be more than, you know, currently 1 in 5.
Mm. But meanwhile, what about the money they were trying to offer the families? Now, they're offering, I think, was it $480,000 each?
Yes. It comes out to be about $470,000 to $480,000 for each family of the deceased person. And so far, the death toll has now, the final body has been found. So the death toll is now at 43. So it's about, the airline's looking at paying out about $20 million U.S. dollars in compensation to all altogether. But the families have rejected this offer. And even though it's the same offer the airline gave to the bereaved families from the last crash 7 months ago, in Taiwan, in the outlying island of Panghu after a typhoon. And we're thinking that the reason why the families in this case have so quickly rejected the offer is because in this case, unlike the last one, evidence from the black boxes show that it could very well be pilot error. So the airline, the families want to hold the airline accountable, and you know, they're demanding more compensation.
And is that likely to happen? I mean, are the airline going to cave in? It's TransAsia. I mean, they're pretty big.
Yes, they are the oldest private airline in Taiwan, and they're the third biggest airline in Taiwan. You know, we're thinking the airline will probably succumb to pressure from the public. There's a lot of anger over why two crashes involving the same airline happened within just 7 months of each other. And, you know, the families have a lot of the public sympathy. So it's likely the company will actually renegotiate the compensation with the families.
Cindy, I mean, does it affect you and your friends, your colleagues? I mean, do you sort of think twice now about getting on board an airplane? Because it must begin to, I mean, you've got to fly. People can't avoid it. But are people worried?
Yes, people are worried. You know, Taiwan has a pretty good history of involving aviation safety. They had some problems with air crashes in the past, in several years ago, but they've improved their safety. So these two crashes within 7 months of each other is another warning to everyone here that they shouldn't take aviation safety for granted. And Taiwanese are some of the most well-traveled people in the world. A very high percentage of the population travel within Taiwan and outside. So people are worried. There are a lot of talk about where you should sit on the airplane, you know. And the experts say, you know, it depends on the crash. It doesn't really make a difference. But a lot of experts are saying, you know, it's better to sit in the second half of the plane because, like, when you're driving, you know, the first half, you don't want to put the kids in the front seats, right? So you want to protect them in the back seat. The back seat is, you know, believed to be safer. But it also depends on whether you're close to the exits and where the plane breaks apart. In this crash, the people who sat closer to where the plane broke apart were able to get out faster.
So you can't really predict it, can you? I mean, it's
one
of those things.
Yes.
However much you look at it, it's just one of those things, isn't it? Well,
yes, exactly. It's pretty worrying. But, I mean, people do have to fly. You know, what do we do? We just, you know, stay in our homes and not go anywhere.
Yeah, and I guess that the plane businesses will still make money because, as you say, people still have to fly.
Yeah, I mean, but one good thing is I think the government is stepping up measures and ordering the airlines to inspect the planes more carefully and to ensure the pilots are properly trained.
Well, that's all they can do, I guess. Cindy, thanks very much indeed for joining us. Lily, you're living in this area where it does seem that so many planes are crashing. Do you have sort of second thoughts or worry more than you used to?
I do, actually, and I feel bad about that because I know that it is safer to fly now than in decades. So it is sort of irrational. But just reading these accounts and, you know, we followed the TransAsia flight also pretty closely and reading about the pilots and, you know, it does make you, I guess when you put sort of a human element on these crashes and you just feel kind of scared.
But you just got to fly. No chance about it, really. There we are. Anyway, let's move on to something else. Now, Steve Strange is dead. You may not have heard of him, but he was, in fact, a pretty big 1980s pop star here in Britain, and he's died from a heart attack at the very young age of 55 while he was on holiday in Egypt. Now, he was a major figure in a music and style movement of the early 80s here in Britain called the New Romantics. Steve, in fact, had a band called Visage, and their biggest hit was called Fade to Grey. I think you get the idea. People in very high collars and lots of makeup and some very stylish, some would say slightly posy poses. A lot of style over substance, some people even thought. But it was an extremely popular and very widespread movement in Britain in the early 80s. And here's a flavour from a documentary that was made at the time.
Go back. That's the whizzing message of World's End, a shop in London's King's Road, outside which Londoners now take their pleasure in pirate postures. It's part of a new King's Road mood that's half a fashion and half a way of looking at the world. Its high priestess is a former singer with another saltwater hero, Adam and the Ants. World's End manager...
Well, you get the image anyway. Well, I've been speaking to Simon Price, who's a music journalist. And first of all, for those of us, many, I guess, outside Britain who never heard of them, I asked him what the New Romantic movement was all about.
The New Romantic scene was a reaction against hardship, really. It was a reaction against the hard times and bleak times of the early days of Thatcherism. And it grew out of punk, and in some ways it was a reaction against punk. The New Romantics were very flamboyant, very decadent, very into frills and makeup rather than zips and leather. And the music tended to be quite synthetic, and polished, as opposed to sort of harsh and abrasive.
Because I remember synthesizers, obviously, and when you heard that, obviously, in Steve Strange's music, the Visage music, but also these very high collars, almost Regency outfits, very strange-looking clothes, back, I think.
That's right. The New Romantics brought back the idea of the Regency dandy, and they kind of democratized glamour. Anybody, if they knew the right sort of vintage or second-hand shop to go to, could achieve that look without necessarily having to have a high-class designer for a friend. So I think it was hugely important. It set the tone for the entire decade of the 1980s.
Which was characterised, of course, by a lot of excess, I suppose. But again, one of the interesting things is that people you wouldn't expect necessarily, someone was saying to me earlier on, people like builders and joiners would come to these clubs, like the one that Steve founded, and dress up and put makeup on and wear these extraordinary clothes. And it was a very strange time in many ways.
That's right. I think there's a myth going around that the New Romantics were all a bunch of sort of upper-class fops. But the fact is, a lot of them came from, you know, the deprived north of England or the Midlands or the East End of London. Spandau Ballet were basically sort of Cockney Barrow Boy types. But they dressed up like aristocrats, and that was the beauty of it, I think.
What happened to it in the end? Where did it go?
Well, it all kind of fizzled out around the time of Live Aid, where I think everybody had got slightly tired of the kind of me posturing of the New Romantics and wanted pop to be a bit more humane. But I think it lost a bit of its fun when that happened.
Simon Price, they're looking back at New Romantics. Lily, I mean, I don't suppose there are any New Romantics in Hong Kong, but they do have these strange youth movements, I suppose, emos, goths, all these kind of things. But the New Romantics was, a bit more colourful than that, really, I think.
In Hong Kong, I really don't see a lot of, I don't really see teenagers walking around in goth and very flamboyant clothing or very trendy. I mean, they're very, you know, trendy sort of young people clothing.
But they're not kind of one particular thing like punks or goths or emos. They don't have a uniform like that.
Right. I think though in mainland China, you start to see a little bit more of that. Maybe because the youth population is much bigger and there are sort of different types of youth culture movements, if you want to call them that kind of...
What do they like? What do Chinese youngsters, what do they go towards? Do they have their own particular style, or is it aping some of these things like goths?
Well, I mean, I think that the... So, you know, after... I mean, since the 1980s, one movement was just basically a rock and roll movement, and sort of singer-songwriters, people that were performing music in their university campuses, and some people say that actually kind of all flowed into the pro-democracy movement in the 80s, and then after the Tiananmen crackdown, that sort of ended that. And so since then, you've got these different movements, and these are sort of divided into sort of more punk or more rock or people getting into hip hop. But all of these movements, they don't have the similar, there's not a political edge to it. And so some academics have described it as a safe cool. And a lot of it, and so, you know, it is imitating Western styles in music, but then combining it with Chinese elements.
Oh, I like that tone, safe cool. Now, Alison, you're in the place which is well, the world of weird in many ways, California. what's the main youth culture movement of the moment? Are punk still around?
Well, in Silicon Valley, I mean, I think the hoodie is in, right? A la Zuckerberg. I think the young people, the young geeks here, like to emulate him and dress down. It's a very casual atmosphere here. And being a geek is cool, and looking like a geek is cool. You know, hair disheveled, hoodie on, and baggy jeans.
So you don't get much of the glamour and the colour and the makeup and all that, which of course was very much the New Romantic. Well, we can't do anything but play out, of course, on Fade to Grey, the great hit of Steve Strange, who's passed away, and, well, the New Romantics, who seem to have gone as well. That's it from Business Matters, from myself, from Alison, from Lily, from all of us here. Thanks for listening, and bye-bye.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.